parts of town, like Michelin Coalus. And also, I was wondering if Rosh Hashiva could address whether he feels that these texts and or Gadot are given enough attention in Talmud Torah and Musar study today.
Should I ask any questions? You want to talk about studying a Gadot?
For the purpose of getting your Shemaya.
I understand Gadot, Chazal, there's some references to it, but generally speaking, the classic presentation of that Rosh Hashanah is Dharmas. Dharmas Adama Techelek speaks about different approaches, different attitudes to the Torah of Agadah. Not necessarily methodological terms, how best to approach the text, etc., but you mentioned, in terms of fundamental approaches, fundamental conceptions of the text. Essentially, the Rambam was, caught as the correct term, but found himself in tension between, on the one hand, a commitment to Chazal, the authority, and then they have certain philosophical relations, which did not always square with what we found they got it. In a sense, this was a replay of questions that I've approached not so much early in the Pesach Mishnayos, but in Be'er Hukim. Same problem I'm had with the doctor's advice of the Kurdish. On one hand, the absolute would speak anthropomorphic terms, and there was a tradition in some of the Gainim went very far in this anthropomorphic direction, took the references to physical elements of the Gata Ben Shalom or psychological elements. Quite literally. I'm shocked by that. And he goes so far as to say that someone who takes it literally and doesn't totally commit himself to Eilagoof is included among one category or another of heretics. So, Rambam says that in Mer Vukhir, this was generated later. Greater debate subsequently, that certainly committed to the text as we have it, B'Seder, but in terms of the interpretation of what the text signifies, there's allegory, there's marshal, etc., etc. Now, some of this allegorization. Rambam took for clear philosophic reasons, in the sharpest sense of the term, some of the ideas which, if you take literally, were very, very problematic. So it has to do with an attempt to diminish to some extent some of the purely narrative elements we deal with, not irrational experience, but not rational experience. There's a certain link between the Rambam saying that you cannot speak anthropomorphic terms, and for him, bear in mind, this had to do not only with physical elements, Yad Hashem, Choraf Hashem, etc., etc., but likewise with states of mind, psychological, emotional states, which is for us, of course, much more problematic. I think we have no problem with wholly on the side of the Rambam when it comes to denying physical anthropomorphism. But emotional anthropomorphism, his anger, his love, his passion, his all of that, which the Rambam, followed by the Chinuch, also weeded out. There were much more problems, that gives you a sense of how deeply he felt about this. There's a link between that, and I was coming to say that some of the parashas which are narrated in certain places, particularly, not really taken literally. It went on three malachim who came to visit Avraham Avinu. It's all a dream. There was no encounter between Esau Shel Esav and Yaakov. It's all a vision, etc. Now there, you can feel, sense that the sacrifice is not so great. But you also can understand why someone whose general approach is more philosophical in nature would be less inclined to narration of historical events. So the Rambam allegorizes it. He goes very far in this direction. He says that after he devotes fully one-sixth of the Manvuchim to challenging Aristotle in the creation of the world, and here he took a very strong traditional stance favor creation as opposed to the eternity of the world as Aristotle, followed by many, assumed. Having said all of that, he says, don't think that I'm insisting upon rejecting Aristotle's position here because of the psukim. Because if I've been able to find my way with regard to the question of anthropomorphism and reinterpret the psukim, I could have done that with regard to the account of creation as well. But for self-philosophic reasons, I'm philosophically inclined to leave everything in place. And all of that is where you're dealing with Chumash mind, that's where they got it is. Analogously, he talks about Agadatis. I'm in the same approach. He tells you there's a Zomit Chelik. There are three, I want to call schools of thought, or three attitudes we've got to difficult Agadatis. Some people who take them literally and accept whatever is there. And these are the things that dreaming simpletons. Amuna, you said the Yerushalayim is strong, but its content is subpar for cyber grounds. And then there are people who take them literally, yeah, that guy is literally, but being rationalists, they can't accept them. So these are people who are philosophically on sound ground, but they're Shemaim's weak, because they do not recognize the authority of Chazal. And the third group, which is his approach, that accepts the authority of Chazal, but doesn't take it literally. Allegorizes a great deal of what's in the Midrashim. That's right. Now, to where does the Rabbi's problem with this? Primarily, with ideas, not with ideas, but with facts. Here and there, you have to sense. We had said with Gatagartis that he felt some of the ideas troubling. But that on the whole was that he managed. Where you had strange stories narrated, and you have this truth through Shas in many places, there said, oh, this is an allegory, it's a mashalayad, etc. Now, was that intended on the Rambam's part to enhance, did you put it to enhance the Yerushalayim? Yes and no. So with regard to some of these, was that so much to enhance the Yerushalayim as to remove stumbling blocks to the Yerushalayim? clearly Agadot is the Midrashim, and two terms are not really synonymous. But in some senses, what's the Midrashim and Agadot is Parshanut. To explain words, psukim, events, personalities, epochs, to fill in all of that. To some extent, many Midrashim, many Agadotis, which are intended not to explain the psukim, on the contrary, they remove the psukim from their literal interpretation, are intended to express ideas, to present values, to encourage epigrammatically certain modes of thought, certain modes of life. That is different from what the Rabbi also does, where you have, yesterday we used tall tales, which is factual narratives. If that didn't exist, would not necessarily reduce the element of Yiras Shamayim. But once it's there, if a person rejects it, that undercuts Yiras Shamayim, because it undercuts a person's relation to Chazal, his commitment to Chazal. And that, of course, is a very serious matter. I mentioned the Rambam because he's a central figure in this whole area, both in terms of presenting concisely a systematic approach to Divrei HaGadol, and because he also became the focus of subsequent debate. The vehement debates which raged around the Nevuach particularly did not have very much to do with the challenge in the Rambam of Bala Halacha. Bala Halacha is a Pesach. He was acknowledged as Mashiach Mevuach Bala Halacha. But there were objections to the word of Mitzvah Deis, which itself was dual. Part of it was the Rambam, part of his allegorization, part in other ways, took certain segments to find Chazal, and in effect emasculated them. That's one objection. Another objection was that some of the ideas and values, which are simply factual elements, but beyond that, those were close to the hearts of many people in Shadim's times, and it was difficult for them to part with that. Let me give an example. If you take number one, Pshuto should be Kreis. And number two, Pshuto should be Chazal. With regard to the whole world of what today would be called superstition, magic, that whole irrational or white magic or black magic or whatever, what have you. The medical bodies should be one vein and the other. There's a psukim which narrate events. Chatzu ben Mitzrayim do this, the Mishnah do that. All of that, of course, is beyond any clear scientific explanation and beyond a non-scientific explanation. It's just things which we take on faith, but we've never seen Chatum of Mitzrayim or Chatum of anywhere else take poles and turn them into snakes into poles, etc., etc. We have statements in the Gemara deal with astrology. To them, said Shabbos clearly, but not only there. And there are certain specific stories. We were there called Rabbi Shachter and Rabbi Zeyla. We were almost Purim. We don't begin to understand the rational. Yeah, the more rational is Mr. Shainim. Allegorized. The Miri couldn't live with that either, so he allegorized. The Mishachter, whatever he did, he walked about. He did. Now, the Rambam, for him, there would be two things problematic with regard to this. One is, what he had to say raised two kinds of objections. One objection was the gap between Pshuto Shubikrois and the philosophic interpretation of Mikrois is more than some people could bear. And they thought the Rabbi was, as some others of his kind, were toying with the psukim in order to bend them to the philosophic relations, which is to a certain extent what Mary Bruchim is all about, part of it. That troubled some people. A lot of people were troubled by other things. The Rabbi at the end of the package. The Pagan Mishnah, which is just primarily the whole world of magic, as I mentioned before, says anyone who thinks that these, the substance of these things, there's reality to them, but we're prescribed for dealing with them because the Torah asks on it, is a fool, a simpleton, an idiot, that it's this kind of faith that only people who are sub-rational, you include all kinds of categories, Tanim and Shaitim and Noshim and whatnot, believe. Anybody who has any kind of intelligence, Baldas, and approaches Hades Hashem rationally, knows that this is just a bunch of nonsense. That whole world is nonsense. Now, what that view which the Rambam ascribes to fools, that's what a lot of the Shem thought. The Ramban, who was a semi-rationalist, clearly held that view. The Ran clearly held that view. A part of it, they held that view, I imagine, because this was Pshutim Shul B'Koyim Shul B'Sugis. Part of it also because removing all of that reorients and shifts the balance between the rational and non-rational elements of reality. It's if someone to come to you and tell you there's DNA and electricity, a bunch of nonsense, and Watson was a phony, and Faraday was a phony, and only people who are fools think there's zero electricity out there, not to mention the negative particles and whatnot. That shook a lot of people up. But that didn't perturb him. And a lot of the debate which then developed, I said, around the approach that I go to was around this. The Rosh, who you open a Piskei Rosh almost everywhere, great, that was the Rambam. We have these issues. He says, he was asked to study philosophy. He says, sure, don't study it. Even the Rambam, it's Kaligabal. Even you feel. So a lot of people said, what happened on no truck with a more rationally oriented study of Agadir. Even the Rambam would have said very clearly, the Rambam didn't think of himself as undermining Kiryas Shemayim. On the contrary, from his point of view, the more philosophical approach to Agadir, that enriches Kiryas Shemayim. He could that's the way it says about Tomtiyah Mishamarakyacha. Don't be a fool, don't be a simpleton. Don't accept things which are not worthy of being accepted. Tomtiyah Mishamarakyacha. Think of him, relate to him in philosophic categories. Of course, a lot of other people felt that this would be undermining for reasons I mentioned before. There were others, of course, attempted to cope with some of the issues which come up in Agadah around the kind of concerns I mentioned before. The Ma'al Gvar whole Sefer Ben Agadah to this issue, trying to take difficult Shtiglich Agadah, some which are difficult morally, some which are difficult scientifically, etc., etc. And it wasn't exactly what the Rambam did, but it was a general direction. The Goyen came along, and this Rambam, with regard to Kishif, etc., etc., he says that briefly what Rambam held, and he says that philosophia ahuva hitatu, two yisoyes, with avuva, without avuva. It's more likely that whoever monkeyed with text was removing the avuva. But what does the Goyen do? He doesn't take it literally either. But he says, yesh ha'emet, but there is a truth, but it's not the literal truth, which the simple people imagine. It's the truth of chachmei emes, nem chachmei kabbalah. That's another way of circumventing, by introducing new categories and new perception of reality, see from this vantage point. People who approach it from different perspectives, they weren't directly attuned, I think, to say, let's learn Agadah for the purpose of Yoshimai. In Chazal, that notion appears. That notion appears. The Sifri, Rav Shavuot, etc. You should learn Divrei Agadah, this will bring you closer to Mishael Bar Yaalon. And in many contexts, Chazal spoke very clearly of, don't imagine that Torah is only halacha. Medrash and Tilim, it's only halacha. Misholim are Torah, etc. Begin to put a guy in Chesed. But I can't say that was the only reason it was learned. As for many people, the Rebbe Sack also learned for that purpose. They learned to know what to do with it. We don't have as rigorous a tradition, either in terms of methodology or in terms of the bottom line, with regard to what goes to the halacha. First, the authority is less clear. The Shadim were divided, and the Achrayim as well, as to how authoritative, in the definitive sense, remember Agadah. Some of the Goyim clearly held it was not Rambam's son. In some respects, deviated in a former kind of direction from his father. But say from B'chamis Hashem also, the theme is, there's no clear authority. Ramban, in his debate, also says that somebody asks a question and the Shemin HaGodes. So some people say the Rabban only said that because of the context of a debate and he had to fend off the defensive tactic. But he wouldn't have said that about Allah. There's some subsequent discussions about this. Some years back, there was a debate this must be a tradition, I saw it, with regard to what Rav Shamshon for Yerushalmi with regard to this. Whether he thought that Agada was a flat tale or not. And as you can imagine, different people drawing upon Rav Shamshon for Yerushalmi's tradition have the views of him, so the quote-unquote Fubar view said, of course he thought about the authority of Chas V'Shalom, they should say that anything which Pesach Chazal was not authoritative. That's what's the name of the fellow, he's the Rav in Riverdale, I forget his name. And someone else said, no, he was caught up in the 19th century national tradition, etc., etc., 19 letters and whatnot. So in part, sense of having to bend all your energies in order to understand, to explain, as you would have to do with Gadim Sakalochir, that doesn't exist to the same extent. The motivation is different, flexibility is different, and the components are different. The word of halacha all turns around halacha, with certain facts which are interwoven as the subject of halacha. And the word of HaKadosh, you have all those components that I mentioned before, there are some others as well, which gives you a very variegated picture. And so much of it, of course, is also conjectural. But this, too, is a question which has and it would not subject a total controversy. There are many midrashim which, particularly those who are more involved in Pashanut, which present dramatically scenes, conversations, dialogues between different personages. I say personages at one level, because of one person, another person. Of course, another level, where the Medrash will present a debate or a discussion, a discourse between a human figure and the Mishnah. I should have said this to him, I've lost the Mishnah of this, or this. And Mishnah debated the Mishnah about so and so. And there's some people who think that not to take these accounts, these discussions literally borders on epicosis. The Medrash says that it took place. I imagine most of us think there's marvelous, marvelous things over there, but we don't take it as a historical fact which is to be narrated. We take it as a sensitive, perceptive, very dramatic exercise of imagination, and as such, with my own study. Ought to begin to decide on the methodology and approach to Agada, as you implied, namely that I don't look to see what will make the most sense, what will most a better sense of figures in Tanakh, etc. What will give you a most coherent view of events, so on and so forth. You don't start with that, but you start with the end result. So let's see what's going to give us the most Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim pills, pet pills. And after we decide what's going to give you the most Yerushalayim, then we'll bend our learning, our study of Agada to attain that end. It is probably a legitimate approach, anything which adds Yerushalayim to be welcome. But I certainly don't think it's the only approach. And whether one selects that or not dovetails with a great deal has to do with the totality of one's intellectual life and how the various components within it, some of which are moral components, some of which are cognitive components. all of that stitches together. There have been attempts to systematize and modes of Avodah, etc. Heinemann, for instance, had a book, Acher HaGadah. But you won't find it most of the Rashi. And you won't find him in the same league with Eretz Yisrael, which had been necessary at the Goyen and the Rosh, but not the same league with Maratz Chayes. Maratz Chayes also did a lot with Agodas and the rationality. Heidemann is a former masculine, but it's about where he stands in the material world. But if you ask me, might there some light be shed on the state of Midrashim, patterns of Midrashim, in quasi-literary terms? Yes. But that would not be starting exactly from where you're starting. That's in a nutshell. Yes.
In the famous 25th footnote of Kol HaDidofei, Soloveitchik presents his family Mesorah that any nation that conspires to destroy Knesset Yisrael becomes, according to the halacha, Amalek. And in a lecture delivered in 1974, Soloveitchik, speaking in halacha terms, believed that, among other leaders, Nasser and the Mufti were within the same category, the same halacha category of Amalek. Did Rav Soloveitchik really believe that we should go and kill such individuals, as is the commandments for Amalek? Does the Daraisa apply to the entire nation, or just to those leaders who seek to destroy us? And how are poskim to consider the potential Chilul Hashem that might result?
I'm asked about this occasionally. And there are people who have good reason, who otherwise do not subscribe to the law of Dolotim for guidance at all, but who find this very useful. People who are opposed vehemently to any form of territorial compromise and who won't dare to have the laws they mention in connection with that issue. But this pleases them. The 1974 lecture you mentioned, I didn't hear.
It's reprinted in one of the books.
What?
It's reprinted in one of the books, though.
Okay.
It's reprinted in one of the books.
I just said it wasn't, it's authentic, I just said it here. The one application which I heard, which had a lemaisa impact, the law was involved in public life, and it should, concerning Eretz Yisrael in a public capacity for decades. Much of that period was a period in which there was fighting between ourselves and the Arab states. You never should have kind of called the U.S. to be about. The one area which, what I heard is that in 1954, spoke before the Mizrahi Convention, cited this the name of the Chaim, but in connection with a totally different issue. That was the issue of German reparations. And he was very much opposed to taking them. And I think what fueled the opposition was primarily moral concerns, ethical concerns. But so it was beefed up somewhat, if you could find some halakha to tag it on. I can't imagine that if you thought what you're asking me about, that you would not have, to some point, made statements to that effect. So if you asked me, I think that's what he really felt. I don't think so. But Chaim felt I don't know. But the question that Reb Chaim is confronted with, Reb Chaim is a very different question is confronted with the Rav. Reb Chaim lived at a time when any discussion of whether to kill anybody was purely theoretical, absolutely not in the mice in any sense of the term. There was no army, there was no Medina Israel, there was no body on earth that had the power to implement, even if we could see to this. But those circumstances, it was much easier to make that kind of a statement with some passionate Avos Yisrael involved as well. If the Rav wanted to take this position in a practical vein seriously, that was at a time when actually it could have been done. But he didn't mention every Arab person who was around. He spoke about Nasser and maybe a couple of other people. And there, it may very well be that he thought that someone was going to go to war and confrontation with the Arab states. If you talk about 74, you talk about a time where they were still talking about throwing us into the sea, et cetera, et cetera. Now that kind of situation is one which lends itself to intensifying one's response and may radicalize one's position. But if you ask me, whether Lamaisa the Lord would have advocated that through the answer, clearly no. The fact of the matter is he never went around advocating it. Number two, to extrapolate, as some people do today, from what the Rav said in 1954, you tell me 1974, to what situation was in the 80s, when that statement was being circulated by people who wanted to take extreme positions on the Arab Israeli conflict, and that something is also out of the question. I'm not so naive to imagine that the Arabs have become our friends, but they, to a great extent, come to terms with the fact that we're here to stay, and now they want their piece of the action, their piece of the pie. They want the whole pie, but in terms of how they plan to do it practically, you don't hear much of that rhetoric anymore, except on the many fringe elements. So even if would have felt that way in the early 70s, I don't think they would have felt that way in the early 90s, let alone in the 21st century. If you ask the why he felt the need to include the Côte d'Ivoire fake, I'm not certain. But bear in mind, Côte d'Ivoire fake is to a great extent, it's divided into three different parts, but to a great extent, the Rav was carried away by his own rhetoric. It's a very highly stylized rhetorical piece, particularly the section of the Shesh Tefikot, as opposed to the first section, Rabba Pray, Evil, the last section, much more moderate in tone. They have it, and sometimes when you speak in your home turf, particularly, you get carried away. But that would explain to me why, in certain contexts, as I mentioned before about the Jewish reparations, the Mizrahi Convention, we spoke with that vein. Kol Yido Fake was initially delivered at Yom HaTzimut in 56, but until it was put into print, 61, 62 thereabouts, I don't know exactly when it was, around that time. And by then, threat, the Arabs to us was still a very real threat. But one of us set out to rework at the publication. It was not for his home audience at YU. He worked on it, and I was there to help with some of the technical details. In the summer, I'll say. So I can't tell you that I'm not puzzled by why he felt need to include it. If my reading is correct, it's not an operative program.
Thank you.
Yes.
One specific pasuk that he quotes in the footnote, in the text, that those who wish to overtake the land of Israel, he quotes the pasuk in Shmuel, that they wish to destroy, heaven forbid, the entire community, both men and women, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, which is ironic because that seems to be the pasuk that we have in destroying Amalek, describing our destruction of Amalek. Interesting,
the same pasuk is used in two different ways. Does Wilkinson have any thoughts on that specific choice of pasuk? I recall he talks about those who've made it as a motto to destroy Klal Yisrael. The pasuk was used to give a sense of what that entailed. I don't remember that was used there, but I think it was there. We can check. Yes.
What's a proper and productive way of studying Mishnah? And what objectives should we have when studying Mishnah in general? And does Pirush HaKahati fit into those objectives?
The Mishnah, as we use it, is different from the way Chazal used it, or Shem administered it. When we speak of Mishnah, we're talking about a particular text. A corpus of which includes what we call the Mishnayos. In Chazal, by that I mean both the Mishnah Novos, the Gemara and Brachos, which speaks about distinction. How about the passage we just read in Mishpatim? This is Mishnah, this is Gemara, and various contexts within which both the tension between Bali Mishnah and Bali Gemara and the harmony between them alternating is described. The Shem generally. Don't assume it as if talking about a text, but a method. The kind of material that you have there. We take Rashi Bar Mitzia. It's probably typical. Possibly some tension between Bar Mishnah and Bar Gemara comes from most sharply in the end of the Mitzias. The Rashi explains Rabbi Shimon de Chochme Svarat Tamei HaMishnah Ulovin Shlo Yusot Ruz Zo Et Zo Betamei Yisu Vayetir Vachri Vaptu Vuhu Nikra Gmara Tazen Li Yamed Rashi speaks a little bit differently. Marak for Parashi Lemala, Shul Vatet Lev Lovin, Stumot Amei Mishnah, Mahim, Shlev Sotra, Shtem, 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 And in effect, what Rashi says is, you have the Mishnayos and you have the explanation of the Mishnayos. That's the Gemara. The Gemara Baba Basra speaks not necessarily of the value, but of the psychological benefits, difficulties, the Luna Mishnah Gemara. There, I believe the Rashbam is a similar formulation. Gemara, Sugat Gemara. Sugat Gemara, Tirutse Mishnayot, Vaitot, Zoi Kira Gemara. Shibnoa Gemara, Ina Benin Alacham, Tuch Mishnah, Gamil Bechat, Gemara Seter, Atanim Mebalei Olam. The Mishnah essentially is what we today would describe as learning keys. It's the raw material with relatively little explanation of what a particular text means, what are the overarching principles, and little by way of viewing the system in systemic terms, reconciling apparent contradictions, etc. Now, this is not a reason for not learning Mishnayos. It's a reason for not stopping there. Mishnayos is a wonderful way of acquiring, building an infrastructure. It gives you a base for knowing the basic halachas, the basic concepts, getting some inkling if you're sensitive to the methods and the approaches. And every so often you encounter a Mishnah which will narrate chalikis between Tanoim, each of which presented reasons for his point of view. The six pack of Pesachim, for instance, a classic example, there are many others. But by and large, in a deeper sense, getting the principle straight, being able to see the relationship with detail and general principles, etc., the Mishnayos don't give that. Now, the Mishnah Novos consigns the Mishnayos to an early stage of personal development. That 5-year period, according to the Mishnah Novos, it starts from 10 to 15. Gemara in Ksuba says the Mishnah is at 12. The assumption is that, particularly in their times when whatever you were to know, you had to know pretty much by heart, a mastery of the raw material, adjusting it, digesting it, enabled you to build a proper base for then having what to analyze. That remains invaluable. And you can see it in yeshiva education, kids who learn to go through Mishnayos at a young age. Their intuitive relationship to a concept, to an idea, to a phrase, is very different from those who come to it much later, and for whom learning the text of Mishnayos goes together without the method of Mishnayos. They learn Mishnah as if it was Gemara. So there's certainly great, very great merit. The outline of the Mishnah, to a great extent, has not been preserved. The Sfarim have done a much better job preserving it. The Ashkenazim more or less so. And the a number of reasons for that, but certainly in the current situation, most kids don't have the patience to wait till they're 15 before they begin analyzing the depth. One time, one's intellectual maturity was attained at a later age, and they could wait. Today you have kids who are dealing with conceptual material at the age of 6. They deal with the pictures and internet and whatnot, but they deal with it. I'd like to wait till they're 15 to find out why you have to do certain things. They also have the attitude of authority, which should enable them to defer. And therefore, Mechanicum, to a great extent, feel that it's important to get started at that earlier age. As I said previously, mission is certainly not something you want to eliminate, but you shouldn't stop there. The crucial issue with regard to Mishnah is, and this is a question which has a history of debate within certain limited areas, has to do with the relationship to Mishnah and the Gemara. Our whole world is built, the world of traditional learning, it's built on viewing and emphasizing the continuity. And viewing what Rabbi Chazal, Gemaras, etc., explain the Mishnah, interpret the Mishnah. Now, here and there, as everyone knows, Amroim challenge Mishnahs, usually not in the very direct confrontation, but that's a difficulty to some of them say the Mishnah, which could be understood to mean it's not part of the corpus, it's an erroneous text, or to challenge on the basis of our. But that's very infrequent, and the gut responses when a person learns the Shulchan Gemara and the kash is somebody from the Mishnah. So if he's Rav, he's Rav Tanu Poli, you should also shame him sparingly. But if he's not Rav, you don't find that. Maskilim, of course, challenged this directly. They say the Mishnah is one world, the world was another world, and Chazal manipulated, Chaz Shalom, etc., etc. He asked him about Kahati. To my mind, Kati is the best people of the Mishnah since the Rambam. I think anybody who has to choose between Kati and the Batanura, without a doubt, Kati is far superior. But, depending on what your purpose is, if you want to get a minimal exposure to the interaction between the Mishnah and the Gemara, or the Gemara and the Mishnah, if you want to get them there minimally, Batanura is fine. Here and there he refers to a Gemara and explains the Mishnah light of the Gemara. But he doesn't go to Machlekes Machlekes Rishonim. He doesn't paint a very broad canvas. Kati does that. He's thoroughly traditional in every sense, unlike some of the other Mefarshim Levi and some of the others. But he's also very comprehensive. Now for young kids who are learning Mishnayos, maybe Kati is more than they can chew. For the people who are teaching them, it's a wonderful tool, and they use it. But it can be used selectively. If Kati explains to a Mishnah, in Zohar, in Tyrus, it's how the Rambam learned, how the Rashi learned, how the Rishonim said, etc. If you have someone guiding you, you can if someone guiding you, then tell them, learn this, don't learn this. But as Jeff Pilch is very good, very, very lucid. Project Operates are very, very lucid. He does not get involved in the problems that says Haim and others, as it's been raised here recently. But what I mentioned before, the Gemara of the Mishnah is, but for us, it's an article of faith, a very sensible one. So I think that is very highly to be recommended. It's also good to serve as a model for some people. It could be a bank clerk and still have such a pirush.
There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, I think it's in the fifth parak, which says that it measures four midos, and one is shalish, shalish, shalach, shalach. So then it says it's a midah bainanis. Next time it says that this is midah stone. So this is midah stone, then, and why are they destroyed for this type of midah? If apparently it's saying it's not such a terrible midah.
The term midah stone, which appears in the Gemara in a number of places, should not be understood to say that someone who does what's mentioned in the Midah Sedoim is as if you were one of the Anshei Sedoim. The Anshei Sedoim said, Anshei Sedoim, Rehme Chatoim, Lashem Me'od. The Midah Sedoim is a bit of some should explain, Zedem Zalei Chasa. If you refuse to give someone something, that's no cost to yourself. And there are many situations, some of which have been specifically enumerated and discussed in the Gemara. I mean, that's the, some of them got to a minor matter. If Yoshim divide up the Yerusha, someone gets it, he's a prayer, he gets it, there's two halakim. He's a Pashut, and he has one of his own fields adjacent to one of the fields of his father. The question is, if you insist and stand upon your full right, you have a right to demand that you're not going to help this fellow get a field which is next to his existing field. You'll have him get a field which is divided in places. It's no sweat off your back. So it's a midah sedoim. So if a person does that, he's a very citizen of sedoim. Chas v'shalom. That particular initiative on his part, some element of spite or whatever it is, or selfishness or excessive possessiveness, that is the partakes of the quality of Sudaim. That's the kind of thing people in Sudaim would do. But that's your whole life is guided by that. This is your whole attitude to people. It means that with regard to a particular issue which came up, you're spiteful. Or you're excessively insistent upon your English not being a scassel, etc., etc. Here's a study that I published a piece. Swan song to America, a Kofi Annan Midat Sedoim, back in the late 60s, if you want to read it. Okay, well.
What was the article?
Kofi Annan Midat Sedoim. Three volumes which were published in the late 60s, early 70s, entitled Hagut Ivrit by America. Hagut Ivrit by America. That's